This is Brad Crandall. Monitor's special guest for this entire half hour is the man whose book has stirred up more controversy, provoked more thought, disturbed, irritated, even enraged more people than perhaps any other book in recent times. The book's title, 6 Seconds in Dallas. It's one of the most recently published theories on the assassination of President Kennedy, and its conclusions depart sharply from the official findings and conclusions of the Warren Commission. The author of this book is a philosophy teacher at Haverford College. We now extend a Monitor welcome to our guest, Professor Josiah Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Crandall.
To begin, sir, if I may, would you mind stating your theory briefly, pointing out, if you don't mind, where it differs sharply and specifically with the findings of the Warren Commission?
Surely. The Warren Commission found that 3 shots in all were fired. They were all fired from the 6th-floor depository window. That 1 shot missed the automobile entirely. 1 shot passed through the president and the governor, and the final shot struck the president in the head.
Mm-hmm. And you feel that there were 4, and what were the points of firing?
I agree with the commission that the depository 6th-floor window was the location of the firing of 2 shots, the first shot and the third shot. The second shot, which struck the governor, was fired from the roofline of an adjacent Houston Street building, and the final shot was fired from the grassy knoll 15 feet down from the corner of the stockade fence.
Mm-hmm. Were all of these rifle bullets?
We know that we have fragments from one of the shots, most likely the third shot, which would indicate it was a rifle bullet, which in fact would not only indicate but definitively establish it was a rifle bullet.
The fragments you mentioned are the ones which the Warren Commission holds are part of actually one of the bullets which penetrated the president and Mr. Connolly, correct?
No, on the contrary. The fragments came from one of the shots which struck the president in the head. These fragments were found in the front seat of the automobile and were ballistically matched to Oswald's rifle to the exclusion of all others. In addition, a pristine rifle bullet, again ballistically matched Oswald's rifle, was found on a stretcher in Parkland Hospital, a stretcher which was used neither in the care of Governor Connolly or in the care of the president.
Mm-hmm. The stretcher was actually located, was it not, on a rollaway cart, which had been part of the activity earlier, but was not, the stretcher was not part of the activity with the president.
No, there were 2 stretchers in this hallway. One of the stretchers most likely contained the governor's body at one point, although the other stretcher, the one on which the bullet was found, may very well have contained a small child.
Mm-hmm.
This turned up in my researches at Parkland Hospital.
I see. All right, sir. Now, one thing immediately strikes me. This is all really the area, perhaps, of criminology rather than philosophy, which is your field. Which automatically brings us around to the question of what first led you into this investigation.
Well, like most people, I was shocked and traumatized by the events of that weekend. My shock and trauma turned immediately into an attempt to find out what happened. And like many people, I clippings,
mm-hmm.
tried to fit the picture together, and kept at it even after the Warren Report came out, kept at it by comparing the Warren Report with the evidence on which the report was based. And as time went on, I became thoroughly more and more disenchanted with the report, more and more convinced that there were profound discrepancies between the conclusions of the report and the evidence. And it was at that point that I began to work in the National Archives, began putting together an alternative and better theory. It seemed to me that the situation we had here with regard to the assassination was a situation which is very familiar in the philosophy and history of science. When one particular theory has been discredited, it doesn't explain the facts. There's an interregnum period during which there is no theory available to explain the facts.
Or a multiplicity which don't account for all of them.
Right. And what I wanted to do was to offer an alternative theory which would bring all the facts
mm-hmm.
into coherence. And that's what I've done in this book, 6 Seconds in Dallas.
Mr. Thompson, your book's premise also includes the theory, and this fascinates me, that Lee Oswald did not fire any of the fatal shots, that he was probably on the first and not the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository at the time of the shooting. Now, how do you get this?
I want to be very precise about this. That's not my theory. On this particular point of Oswald's guilt, I don't know. And it seems to me when we have conflicting evidence of this sort, it's incumbent on the responsible observer, the responsible researcher, to say just that. We have a conflict here. Oswald may have been the man who fired two shots from the depository, or he may not have been. And at the present time, the evidence is simply conflicting on this point.
Would you say that the weight of evidence would seem to indicate that he probably was? The paraffin test, such as it was, the killing of Officer Tippett, whatever other factors have entered into this, the fact that it was his rifle, that I don't think there's any doubt about it. Was
no, I believe that Oswald's rifle was used, was fired from that window. Officer Tippett's killing is another thing entirely, and is logically independent of whatever happened in Dealey Plaza. As to the paraffin test, this is a very troubling sort of thing, because it seems that the test on Oswald's cheek was negative. Now, I understand that the inventor of this paraffin test ran some tests with Carcanos in California and determined that firing a Carcano would usually give some sort of nitrates on the cheek and thus would yield a positive test. So it seems to me that the paraffin test is at best problematical.
It shows only that he fired a weapon. It doesn't show necessarily that he fired that rifle.
Yes, it was positive on his hand, which might indicate a number of things. Might have indicated
including
firing
the pistol
revolver,
that killed Tippett, yes.
Possibly, or it could indicate simply nitrates from smoking, from washing one's hands, from things of this sort. It's a rather unreliable test, I believe.
At best, yeah. Although, again, it becomes part of the evidence. Well, there are several factors, though. Theoretically, criminologists, lawyers, when they're proving a case and so forth, they take access, opportunity, motive, these kinds of things, and construct them into a plausible doctrine. In Oswald's case, we know, for example, according to his wife's testimony, that we know that it was his weapon, step one. We know, number two, as nearly as we're able to ascertain, that he took that weapon with him that morning. Does it seem reasonable to you that if he did not fire the shots, he was at least privy to the plan?
Well, yes, I would say not from the facts you mentioned, which are actually very problematical. The fact that Oswald carried that rifle with him this morning is extremely problematical because of the size of the package which he allegedly carried into the depository. If the two witnesses who saw him carry that package are correct, and their testimony corroborates each other on this, the package was much too small to carry even the disassembled rifle. Given other facts, not the ones that you mentioned, I would generally agree that Oswald probably had some sort of knowledge of the plot, was involved in some way. But, you know, these are peripheral matters. What I'd like to get to are the evidence. Preeminently, the Zapruder film, which is still and always the most essential piece of evidence in the assassination. And one of the most interesting things which happened to me in this whole investigation was to learn that the copy of the Zapruder film studied by the commission was not the best copy available, was, in fact, a copy of a copy. I studied that copy in the National Archives in the summer of 1966 and frankly was unable to see the exact point when the governor was hit. I went to work for Life magazine in November of 66 as their special consultant on the assassination, and at that point was astounded to detect the difference in clarity between Life's copy, marvelously clear, and the copy I'd studied in the archives. And the result of this was that immediately upon looking at Life's transparencies, I was able to see the impact of a bullet on the governor. At one frame, Zapruder frame 238, the governor's shoulder collapses, his cheeks puff, and his hair is dislodged.
A definite impact response.
I think so, and I've pursued this with experts in the field. As you see, I'm a philosophy professor. When I need expert knowledge, I go to the experts. In this case, Dr. Cyril Weck, director of the Institute of Forensic Sciences in Pittsburgh, who also had a chance to look at that Life copy of the film, and who believes that Zapruder frame 238 shows an impact on the governor at that point.
Which would be 1.5 seconds after the bullet struck John Kennedy.
Well, it would be at the minimum 14/18ths of a second, actually, 14 Zapruder frames. We see the president reacting to a hit at Zapruder frame 224. Since he's behind the sign earlier than that, we only know that he was not hit prior to 210. So it's on the order of 3/4 to 1.5 seconds. Now, that's too long a time to have been the same bullet.
And too short a time for the same rifle to have fired another.
Right. So if Counsel Redlich is correct when he says that to say that that if the president and the governor were not hit by the same bullet, then this means there must have been more than one assassin. If he's correct in this view, and I think all the constraints in the case indicate that he's absolutely correct in this, then clearly this one piece of photographic evidence indicates in and of itself that there was more than one person firing on the motorcade.
Monitor's guest is Josiah Thompson, author of the book 6 Seconds in Dallas, a personal theory on the assassination of President Kennedy. We'll continue our interview in just 1 minute, at which time Professor Thompson will comment on the conflicting ballistics reports and whether or not the Warren Commission should reopen its investigation. We invite you to stay on the Monitor Beacon.
The name's the same, but the game is different. When Fortune Phone premieres on WNBC, January 29th. All day, any day, the new Fortune Phone could ring for you. Listen and learn how you can be a Fortune Phone winner when WNBC Radio premieres the week of January 29th.
January 29th, radio premiere week on WNBC New York. Do you know that over 3 million people have kidney disease right now and don't know it? And do you know there's an artificial kidney machine that can keep people alive indefinitely or until they recover? But not everyone can get the machine because of one little thing. There isn't enough money. That's like a death sentence for a lot of people. Please don't make us decide who shall live and who shall die because there isn't enough money. Give to your local chapter of the National Kidney Foundation or write Box 353, New York, New York, 10016. At 19 minutes after the hour, you're back with Monitor. I'm Brad Crandall, and our special guest this half hour is Professor Josiah Thompson, author of the book 6 Seconds in Dallas, a controversial volume on the assassination of President Kennedy. The book disputes many Warren Commission findings. Its major claim is that not one, but 3 assassins fired on the president, and that not 3, but 4 bullets were fired. Now, Professor Thompson, what about the fact that no agency investigating the assassination has found any other bullets coming from any gun other than Oswald's? How do you then support your theory of 4 shots from 3 different locations, 2 of which came from other guns? In short, what happened to those bullets?
Well, of course, what you say is false. If this were the case, then, of course, it would be very extremely difficult to explain this. But since what you said is false, it's not that difficult. There are a number of fragments that we found in the automobile and in the president's head which were not ballistically identifiable. We don't know where they came from. In addition, there was a lead dust, small lead stars, scattered throughout the cranial cavity of the president's head. These were detected on X-ray, and we have testimony concerning it. Now, given a military-jacketed, copper-jacketed bullet of the kind that was fired from Oswald's rifle, this sort of lead dust is not constant with the impact of that kind of a bullet. It is constant with the impact of what's called a frangible bullet, either a fulminated mercury round or a soft-nosed lead bullet. So there are actually some indications turned up by the investigative agencies of the impact of bullets other than the kind fired from Oswald's rifle.
Are not both of the bullets of the type you describe, however, do not both of them tend, as opposed to a military rifle like Oswald's, which has a very high penetration factor,
yes,
and is designed for that purpose?
Clearly.
On the other hand, are not both of these other bullets designed to be what we call stoppers? In short, they are not. The bullet itself is soft, intended to mushroom,
mm-hmm,
and one of two things, either to lodge within or to tear one awfully big hole coming out.
And, of course, this is exactly what we have. For example, given the commission's theory that a rifle bullet from Oswald's rifle penetrated the president's neck, the penetration holes were very small. The bullet that entered the governor's back blew out a hole 5 centimeters in diameter across his chest and then went on to shatter his wrist. The impact on the president's head was massive. It produced just the kind of non-penetrating but exploding sort of effect that you indicate.
And yet the bullet is nowhere to be found.
Of course, after an impact of that sort, of a frangible bullet, no bullet would be expected to be found. As I say, there is evidence, namely this lead dust, stars of lead in the president's head, which would indicate the impact of that kind of a frangible round.
As a man who has traced this much with very careful scientific measurement, I would assume that you have some rough estimate of the probable weight of the various bits of dust and lead factor that you're talking about here.
These bits of lead dust and lead stars were never weighed. They were detected on X-rays as spread throughout the president's cranial cavity. No attempt was made to scrape them up or to or to weigh them, is partly due to the circumstances under which the autopsy were performed, as you know.
By a couple of naval surgeons who didn't know beans about autopsies.
Well, this seems to be the opinion of Dr. Cyril Wecht and Dr. Halpern here in New York. I defer to their opinion on matters of this sort, and that does seem to be the case. Clearly, the time factor was important, too. They were rushing. Mrs. Kennedy was in the hospital after undergoing this awful ordeal. They wanted to free the body to let it be returned to the White House. So perhaps many things that you or I might have wanted to have been performed in that autopsy room were not performed, and I suppose now we suffer the consequences from them.
Just as a certain amount of the entry and exit wound evidence was automatically disturbed by the attempts to keep the president alive.
Clearly, the tracheostomy incision at Parkland Hospital.
One more thing. Have you brought this investigative work to the attention of the Warren Commission?
No, and I think this is one of the most awkward things about the legal situation right now, that there is no particular agency of government or no investigative body which is in existence, which is charged with looking into problems concerning the assassination of the president. As far as the government's concerned, case is closed. Mm. Silence.
In fact, that was the specific and announced purpose of the establishment of the Warren Commission, was, of course, to, quote, ascertain the facts, publish them, and close the case.
Yeah, many people have held that it would have been a good idea if the commission had maintained itself in existence to answer criticisms. It seems to me that that does make sense.
I've got a very personal question to ask you, Doctor. This whole thing now, the president has now been dead over 4 years, and there's been a steady flow, of which yours is the latest, of books purporting to present different theories, different doctrines. How do you find yourself in relationship to these other people, and how do you rate them in this same search?
This is the first work in the field that's attempted to bring all the evidence together. With the publication of Sylvia Marr's book, Accessories After the Fact, this last month, and with my book, 6 Seconds in Dallas, it seems to me now a kind of objective scholarship is now beginning to move to the fore. We've had attacks on the attackers, and now, for the first time, it seems to me that we're getting an attempt at an objective presentation of the evidence and an attempt to deal with that evidence.
On this premise, do you think the assassination investigation should be reopened?
Oh, clearly. I mean, private individuals have moved probably to the far limits of their resources and capabilities. Now one needs, first of all, and preeminently, certain frames released by Life magazine for inspection, and namely these critical frames, 237 to 240 from the Zapruder film. We need valid experts like Dr. Wecht or Dr. Halpern to view the autopsy photos and x-rays, which are sequestered in the National Archives. As you know, Congressman Kupferman made an attempt over a year ago to get Dr. Halpern and Wecht to see those photos and was rebuffed by the Johnson administration and by the Kennedy family. That needs to be done. And then in addition to that, we know of the existence, by inference, of a whole host of Secret Service reports, FBI reports, that are still classified in the National Archives, that have to do with interviews in Parkland Hospital, interviews with witnesses, which in and of themselves might throw great light on this. Now, only some sort of governmental body charged with subpoena power and with the right to interrogate witnesses under oath, it seems to me only a body of that sort can make much progress at this point. And for our own selves and political discussion in the future, I so hope that somebody of that sort would be set up shortly.
One very broad comparison which has crossed my mind. The Warren Commission, within its own frame of reference, investigated, in effect, a killing. You have, quite scientifically, quite carefully, and with great propriety, as nearly as I'm able to tell, have largely investigated photographs of that killing rather than the killing itself. Would that be a fair comparison?
Well, the killing itself doesn't exist after those 6 seconds. The only way one can get back to those 6 seconds are through three different sources. One, the physical evidence. Two, the memories of the witnesses who were there. And three, photographs. And of all these things, it seems to me photographs offer us the best access back there.
Well, certainly the memories of the witnesses are likely to be considerably less than accurate.
Sure, they decay, and many witnesses bring their...
Well, they were distorted from the beginning.
Sure.
You know, every lawyer knows that an eyewitness is the worst kind you can have. He's liable to go any which way.
But as you may not know, there were some 22 photographers taking pictures in Dealey Plaza, and only about a quarter of these photographs were ever viewed by the commission or studied by the FBI. There are a whole host of these published in this book for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made an effort on the basis of those photographs then, using physical evidence, and going back to interview a number of witnesses, which the commission never touched. On the basis of all this, old evidence studied by the commission and new evidence discovered mm-hmm. since then, to reach what I think is a much more founded and more justified conclusion about what happened than that which was reached by the commission.
One more question. In the time since the preparation of this book, or in the future as a, let's say, a corollary to your activities here, has the thought occurred to you of pursuing the investigation of and attempting a similar set of techniques, perhaps, on a killing where not so much political pressure exists, just to see if the techniques hold up with the other evidence available?
I want to get back to philosophy. I find this whole public arena, the fact that I'm here talking to you today, I'm not a performer or an entertainer. I find myself very uneasy in this whole world.
Can't be any tougher than lecturing.
It's quite different. And the fact that I'm right now being sued and up to my eyebrows and lawyers also has something to do with that. No, I want to go back to philosophy, to teaching, to my students. This is what I love, and this is the world I want to stay in.
Thank you, Professor Thompson, for joining us on Monitor this evening. Our special guest this half hour has been Professor Josiah Thompson, author of the provocative, controversial book on the assassination of President Kennedy. His book is titled 6 Seconds in Dallas. Listening to Monitor, available all across America on NBC Radio every weekend. WPTF Raleigh, North Carolina is NBC for Eastern Carolina. Monitor returns shortly with the world and Washington, an in-depth analysis of the United States' role in the world, produced by NBC News. This is Brad Crandall.
This is Bill Ryan. For complete and comprehensive news coverage, plus sports with Kyle Roach, tune to News of the World, weeknights on NBC Radio.